Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me, as always, is the one, the only, he has been confused as my twin most of the time, Mr. Spencer Williams.
What's up, man?
The resemblance is uncanny.
Uncanny.
Speaking of uncanny, we also have with us intern manager,
yes.
Amy with us.
Hello. Yeah, me and my
I mean, we're
title.
Giving you a better title, so you got to come with better intros to this.
You
I mean,
just, there was a...
Hello! Like your Mrs. Doubtfire over here coming in with...
That
help is on the way!
Help is on the way, dearie. Help is on the way.
Speaking of help, these two are here to help me bring about the conversation for our latest review of the week, and that is our talk on Ryan Coogler's Sinners. Stick around as we dive into this movie. We talk about it and get into the nitty-gritty. It's been the talk of the town since its debut, even before then. And we're going to get into a lot of the intrigue, the information, and even some of the pushback on it. So we'll dial into that as soon as we get going. But before we do, Spencer, give us them opening credits.
Tune into brand new episodes each and every week.
Week!
And I've made sure it's been every week, so
on all your favorite streaming platforms and over our website at filmlosophers.com. Also, connect with us on the socials at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter and Instagram and Threads at filmlosophy101 and also on Blue Sky at Filmlosophers Podcast.
Yes! Yeah. We have a website. Did you say, you said Blue Sky? Yeah,
yes.
I'm sorry.
I said many things.
You did.
It's nice to know that you're listening.
I literally got distracted for a half second on that last part. I was like, we have a website, filmlosopherspodcast.com. There we got allegedly over 300 episodes, everything from action, anime, comedy, suspense, thrills, and chills. If you're looking for it, we got it. Head on over to our website at filmlosopherspodcast.com. You can also check us out wherever podcasts are streaming, and that's iTunes, Libsyn, Player FM, Audioboom, Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn, iHeart, and Amazon Music. Tune into your heart's desire on any one of those platforms. Look for us there. At The Filmlosophers, give us a follow or subscribe, and if you like what you hear, give us a 5-star review. We've earned it.
We have.
Yes, please.
We'll give you the rest of the social links at the end of the episode. This has been a long-awaited episode for us for a while, ever since we knew this movie was coming out. It's just, let's just be honest, Ryan Coogler has been one of those few filmmakers who has really set himself apart. It would be almost, I guess, disrespectful. I don't want to say disrespectful because it's not really a diss, but it would be almost I guess not correct to say that he would be like the next Spike Lee, because he's ultimately doing what is uniquely him.
Yeah, plus he's making a name for himself.
Exactly. Yeah. That's what I mean.
A one of one.
Yes. Yeah, to say that he's the next Spike Lee is to kind of just discredit everything that Ryan Coogler has done 100%. So far. So we're going to get into that conversation. But before we do, guess what, guys?
Please tell me it's not another conspiracy.
It's a conspiracy theory. Oh, yes. We're bringing this one back.
Listeners, as much as I am.
Nobody is. We're all going to endure. I felt last week's was a little kind of meh. It was a pretty softball. I mean, it was practically T-ball. I mean, as far as giving you guys tossing it up and you just was like, you know what? Yeah.
I said, yeah, immediately. And you got mad at that.
Yeah, because there was no conversation.
You
I was kind of bummed.
So you wanted to be controversial.
Like Mulder from the X-Files, the truth is out there. We're going to dig deeper into this one. And I got something for you guys that might make you guys actually think a little. You guys ready?
Mm-hmm.
I'll try.
Now, the problem is, With this one, I don't know if Spencer, I don't know if you've actually seen, actually, I know you've seen the first Fast and the Furious.
Yes.
And you're aware of the other movies.
I'm aware there are more than one movie. Yes.
And you're aware of kind
if
of how.
Hobbs and Shaw.
Yes. And well, I know because I was there with him.
Yes,
I hope he saw it, or else that review was very
an elaborate deception.
But you've seen all the other movies, or I'm sorry, you're aware of how bombastic the movies get in terms of escalation?
All I know is that, like, I think, what is it, after three or four, it just goes, starts to go, like out into the stratosphere.
Because ultimately, okay, let me paint a picture for you, okay? Uh-huh. So, obviously, the first one we saw.
Yes.
The first one you saw, it's your typical blah, 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 things happen. The end, you know, he crashes his car, and then Paul Walker's character, he ends up giving him, Brian, he ends up giving him the keys to his car so that he could get away, right? You're familiar with that. That's how it ends. Brian walks off into the sunset while Dom drives away and is a free man, and Brian ends up being let go from the police, whatever. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's ultimately how it ends, right? Mm-hmm. So in the subsequent follow-ups to that one, we get in the second film, Brian ends up going to Florida where he teams up with Tyrese Gibson's character. And they are kind of recruited by the FBI, so to speak, to help break up some kind of smuggling ring that's been going on in the Florida Keys or in the Florida area. And they pretty much put them in the game so that they can help, you know, bust that open.
Right.
In the third one, it's about Tokyo. Right. Not really
Tokyo Drift.
Tokyo Drift, i.e. it's not really about the original crew. It's kind of like a story that's in the universe of.
Yeah, but it didn't take place out of order or something.
It does. Mm-hmm. Actually, yeah. It does. And then we get the occurrence of Dom at the end of that one, kind of talking about how, you know, his friend Han, you know.
How Han was a friend.
Yeah, how Han was a friend. Han being one of the guys who's a mentor to somebody in the film, and he ends up dying three quarters of the way in the movie.
Right.
So as the story goes on, it goes from there to them becoming almost like world-class spies and agents who know how to drive.
Yes.
I mean, it kind of gets to the point to where they're hijacking trucks for gas during a recession, mind you, when that film came out, and gas was like, they're hijacking trucks. They're getting out by the skin of their teeth. They're figuring out they're becoming friends with, like, Ludacris comes back into the fold. He was in the second one and he's like this world-class hacker and, you know, they're able to do X, Y, and Z. Then they start going on these like world bound missions where they're trying to do things and they're like, they're stopping, like James Bond level villains from, like, ultimately destroying the world.
Right, because I remember hearing complaints from, like, didn't this movie start, like, this series start off with just, like, regular street racing?
I told you that. Yeah, I told you that. And it gets even crazier. Like, they learn how to, someone is able to, like, hack a submarine, a World War II or a Cold War submarine. And then at one point, Tyrese Gibson and Ludacris's characters end up strapping Wile E. Coyote, like this rocket to this car that they're able to fly into space in. And then there's one where they're like, Dom does this whole thing where he drives off a cliff and he hits the edge of a rope bridge. The rope bridge breaks, but the rope itself attaches to the wheel well of the front left tire. And he's able to swing around to the other side to get away from
Tarzan's.
Yeah. His car. No. His car Tarzan.
Yes. I was about to just clarify. This is the car, not the person.
If it was the person, it would be more plausible.
Yeah. I mean, and it builds up to this most recent one, which had Jason Momoa come in.
Crazy Jason Momoa.
Well, he's.
Oh yeah, I remember him being in the trailer for that.
He's actually good. I'll give you that much. He's fun. So truth be told, I made Amy watch all 10 of them except for the Hobbs and Shaw one. I don't think you saw the Hobbs and Shaw.
I did not.
That's the only one she hasn't seen.
That's the one where I'm like, this is a fun movie. And
that's,
like,
which, see, oddly enough, that's the one with
conversation.
That's the one, mind you, though, with Roman Reigns. So
I don't care about WWE's Joe.
Okay. Either way, so the last one is actually pretty fun because you have now a very
Wait. Hobbs and Shaw is the one where they go to Samoa, right?
Yeah.
And the family on the island. Oh, I saw that one.
Oh, you did?
Yep.
Okay. Well, then, yep. Okay. Yeah. So ultimately,
like,
this this last one gets pretty much to the point to where, like, they're blowing up, like, the Vatican. As probably distasteful as it is to talk about right now, they blow up the Vatican, the villain does, and Dom gets framed for it and everything. Ultimately, it's been a whole crazy mess, right?
Right.
So here is my film theory for this franchise, okay. Not one singular movie. It's based on the first one, but its implications are franchise-wide. The Fast and the Furious sequels are Dominic Toretto's coma dreams. Now, remember at the end of the first film, he is hit by another truck when they're doing that last race, him and Brian, right? Mm-hmm. They make it past the train, but his charger hits a truck, gets totaled, and it flips and whatnot and comes to a stop, right? We recall that. This theory is postulating that he actually survived, but he was left in a comatose state. Every single subsequent follow-up film is his comatose dreams of him and his friends. And the couple of things that kind of build on that theory are, the first thing, his charger was totaled. Mm-hmm. How the heck does it keep getting rebuilt the same way in each movie? It appears just about in every film, including, including Tokyo Drift.
Yeah, it does. In Tokyo, 100% normal.
Yeah. Secondly, there are a lot of people, spoiler alert, if you haven't seen any of these movies, Spencer doesn't really care.
I don't. It's fine.
So in several of these movies, people potentially die.
But they come back.
Yes.
And they're 100% okay. There's no scars. There's no
And mind you, it is a complete, like, do you remember that scene from Misery where she's like explaining how, you know, he didn't get out of the cock-a-doodle car. There are scenes in this franchise where there's no way they could have survived it. But they make it seem as though there was a way and they survived. Because there's clearly in Tokyo Drift, Han ends up upside down in his car because they're being chased by some rival gang. And his car ends up flipped upside down and it's leaking gas because he got hit by somebody trying to get away from them. The car is leaking gas and the other protagonist in the film tries to run towards the car. They can clearly see Han. He is upside down in this vehicle.
He's still alive,
but he's bleeding. And then the car explodes.
Mm-hmm. 100%.
Boom. So everything. Han is dead.
Yes. And it's toasty. Like, it's not like, he is stuck. He is literally using his hands. He can't get himself unbuckled. You're freaking out at this point when you watch this because you're like, oh, you're the cool dude. We want what you can get out of this. And then boom.
And then
in the eighth or ninth movie,
it is shown that, the guy who, the CIA operative, who his name is, what was it, Mr. Nice or Mr. I don't know.
He's a CIA operative.
He's got a very, very generic name that he actually gives him. And he ultimately is the guy behind Han getting out safely. So they're looking at it from a different view. The car explodes and then Han is actually behind this CIA operative, like, hey, you know, we got to do this. He goes, yeah, I know, whatever. And yeah,
it messes with you so bad because you're like, you should be dead, or at least you should have a new hairstyle and be slightly crispy. No. No, Spencer, I have no qualms saying that 1 through 3 I thought was an anthology. I was okay with that. I was like, okay, Dom is like the thread that goes through it, but it made sense as it was like a collection of stories about Fast and Furious with loose ties to Dom. After 3, it resets and it's all like, psych, we got you.
Which I think the fourth one on, it was kind of restructured by director, I believe, Justin.
I don't know, and I really don't care. So Justin the Lin. Concept of this conspiracy theory where it's, Dom essentially is dying and in a coma somewhere.
I didn't say he's dying. I just said he's in a coma.
I think this is not, again, second week in a row, not only totally plausible, it makes sense because he knows of Han, but he doesn't really know where Han was, right?
Who?
Dom in the first, after the first one.
No, so because here's the funny thing. Mind you, the franchise, like you said, you painted it perfectly. It's out of sequence. Mm-hmm. The fourth film shows that Dom, Letty, the girlfriend, Michelle Rodriguez's character,
yes,
and Han are actually in, they're in Cuba? No, they're in
Colombia?
I think they're in Colombia. They're somewhere
in South America.
In south of the border. They're somewhere heisting gas from gasoline trucks. And Han, they're pretty much like, oh, Dom's been made, so we can't stay here because, you know, Dom, you know, they're going to come for Dom. So they all end up having to split up. And Han's like, yeah, I'm going to go to Tokyo. I hear they're doing pretty cool stuff there. So that's kind of the I guess, catalyst for him going to Tokyo and being established. Right. So the beginning of that film kind of shows the separation of time because it jumps forward in time, obviously, to, you know, the current day and age in that film, but it establishes that part three is like way somewhere else in the timeline.
Right.
So, but yeah. So that's the theory. What do you guys think?
I think that if you're like me and you watch the first one mm-hmm. and then you watch Hobbs and Shaw mm-hmm. where someone screams their black Superman and yeah. it started with,
and I believe him. It's Idris Elba.
Yeah.
It's Spencer. Like, I mean, come on.
I will accept Idris Elba as our black Superman. I think we have a strong consensus.
I mean, this I have no acceptable. Problem saying Idris Elba is my tribal chief. Like Idris Elba is like just, you know, I will absolutely acknowledge that man.
Yes.
Yes.
See, yeah. Like
Spencer's like, I don't know what to do with this.
but like, it's such a far gap. I can't even think of another franchise that's done anything like that. So where... Yeah, someone must be dead or dying,
yeah.
And like this is a fever dream because it doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't, and honestly, I read this theory and I'm like, I didn't even get past the title of this theory, and I'm like, that works, that makes sense. There's thought into this, and there's conversation that I can pull out of this, but at the same time, this is the most no-brainer theory of everything because the whole movie franchise is a no-brainer. It's like absolutely like it doesn't make sense.
No, it didn't make sense to begin with. And then the farther, again, when I said it was an anthology, I was like, oh, okay. It's like, you know, this is going to sound really ridiculous, but not all the episodes of Thomas the Tank or Thomas the Train Engine, whichever you may have just specifically, they're following Thomas. They follow his friends, like Percy or like Diesel. Yes, shout out to Bullet Train. We yeah. see you. Like, there's purpose in the story inside the universe. So my, like, going in, I was like, okay. Like, I didn't even know me starting on three, which still, there's a consensus, it's the best one. It was in such a weird space. But then when you're like, do you know what? Dom Toretto is totally like in a coma somewhere. And this is just a fever dream. And go, do you know what? If a car can Tarzan, I have no doubt that this is some, this is some guy that's like, you see him, he's just like, yeah, yeah. Oh, I remember briefly seeing Jason Momoa on a poster. And now he is a villain in my story mm-hmm. to save my children. Like,
which mm-hmm. I know you haven't gotten to this point.
You don't have but to,
but
okay.
But I have to say, Jason Momoa is probably one of the funnest villains I've ever seen in a film.
I cannot wait like, for him to be Lobo. Like, that's yeah. I know that's a total like, aside, but oh my god!
Like Jason Momoa as an anti-hero, not in the Minecraft movie kind of anti-hero, but mm-hmm. as kind of like, not even like just an ambiguous chaos entity, almost like the Joker. Mm. That's what he is in this movie. And he is having the most fun. He is completely unhinged.
He's the Joker with extra Deadpool
Spencer,
energy.
He's literally, he's waiting on something he's waiting on getting information from one of the people that works with him. And all the while, he's literally in a bathrobe painting the fingernails of his dead compatriots. People who worked with him. They're literally, and he's literally having like a spa day and he's painting their nails and he's talking to them and you don't know they're dead until you see them. Some of them got shots to the head. Some of them got to their chest, but they're literally on lawn chairs near his house that he used to live in, and he's drinking like some kind of pina colada or whatever, and they're talking like they're in a like a nail salon. Mm-hmm. That's how unhinged he is. It is so great.
He's literally pitch perfect, and even like it's so fun.
The rest
and
of the movie is god awful.
Yeah, but you could we could probably find him a compilation of just Jason Momoa. Don't need anything.
No, he has to take the good with the bad.
You could just watch that movie and completely miss everything else and be like, okay, this was fun. I just know that these are bad guys and now they're good guys, but might be bad guys, and he's a bad guy. Yeah. Like you could get away with it.
So There's a lot to it, but I mean, it is a interesting kind of turn of play for the whole franchise. And so,
yeah.
But speaking of turn of phrase, we are going to turn this conversation around and talk about the recently dropped. Now, this has been a long awaited conversation that we've been wanting to talk about since we saw the film, since we heard about the film. And now that we have just a little warning, this might run a little longer.
Spoilers.
Well, this is going to probably run a little longer than normal. So buckle in, get your popcorn ready, because we are going to dive into this week's conversation of Sinners. This movie has absolutely changed the game. I know I'm getting ahead of myself, but holy shnikes. Like, I am amped to talk about this movie. Yeah, so without further ado, I'm not even going to talk anymore. I'm just going to pass it over. Spencer, give us that official synopsis goodness.
Trying to leave their troubled lives behind, twin brothers return to their hometown to start again, only to discover that an even greater evil is waiting to welcome them back.
Written, co-produced, and directed by Ryan Coogler, the film stars Michael B. Jordan in dual roles, as well as Haley Steinfeld, Miles Keaton, Jack O'Connell, Wunmi Mosaku, James Lawson, Omar Miller, and Delroy Lindo. Couple key pieces about the film. So, I had to look up just to make sure I got all this information down, because it is actually pretty cool information. Ryan Coogler said he had Metallica on his mind when he was laying out the story's rhythm and beats. He said, "I wanted the movie to have the simplicity and simultaneously the profound nature of a Delta blues song. But I wanted it to have the contrast, variation, and the inevitability of a great Metallica song like One," he says. "It starts off with almost like an easy listening solo, you know what I'm saying? And then it just goes bat crazy in a way you could have never seen coming. And at the same time, it felt like it was going to go there all along." The movie's basically that, he states. Uniquely enough, because this, because he says that it's based on kind of the rhythm and the beats of Metallica song, Lars Ulrich, the drummer for Metallica, is actually credited as one of the drummers in the movie's scoring orchestra. Mm-hmm. So that's actually really cool. Another piece of information, Ryan Coogler said that two of his biggest influences film-wise for this movie were From Dusk Till Dawn from 1996 and The Faculty in 1998.
Really?
Both directed by Robert Rodriguez.
Hey.
He also explained in an interview that Remick was partially inspired by the character Death in Puss in Boots, The Last Wish.
Yeah, I remember reading that.
Noting both his eyes and demeanor. That's actually really cool to hear that he actually took influences from movies like From Dusk Till Dawn and The Faculty. You know, both of these movies being, icons from the late 90s as far as horror films. They really kind of set the tone for what was to come for sci-fi as well as the vampire kind of genre. So when you see movies like From Dusk Till Dawn, there was a lot of like subtlety to it, but some parts of it were kind of just in your face, ridiculous. And that's the nature of Robert Rodriguez.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Last but not least, film wasn't his only inspiration, however. Coogler also stated that an episode in The Twilight Zone, as well as the Stephen King novel Salem's Lot, were massive influences as well. He stated the novel Salem's Lot is a massive influence on the film. Then there's a real deep cut influence. My favorite thing ever made, The Twilight Zone, and my favorite episode is called The Last Rites of Jeff Myrtle Bank. So he says probably Salem's Lot and The Last Rites of Jeff Myrtle Bank are probably the biggest influences. So just to clue you guys in, if you're not familiar, Salem's Lot is ultimately a novel Stephen King wrote about a town called Jerusalem's Lot, where ultimately a uprising of vampires occurs, and they slowly begin to take over the town. It's a very unique story. They've adapted it several times. They've made sequels non-novel based, because he never made a sequel to the book. In fact, the only sequel that Stephen King has ever written was the sequel to The Shining, which is called Dr. Sleep. That's the only book that he has ever created as a sequel to his novels outside of the Gunslinger Dark Tower series. Mm-hmm. They're not really sequels, but they follow in suit of like the world itself. And then The Last Rites of Jeff Myrtlebank, it's ultimately a story about how a man, so there's a funeral for a man named Jeff Myrtlebank, and during the course of his funeral, he ends up actually waking up during the middle of his funeral and coming back to life, ultimately. And everybody in the town starts, you know, praising it as a miracle of sorts. And then it gets to a point to where he starts doing a little, some weird things that kind of get the town suspicious of him. They do a variation of it in, there was a show on Fox called Night Visions that I was a huge fan of. And they actually did a variation of that story in there with, what's his name? The disgraced Quaid brother. Randy?
Randy
yeah. Quaid. With Randy Quaid as
Dennis eats shrimp really awkwardly.
What?
Sorry, I was thinking of what we did.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Spencer got my joke. It was
that wasn't really a joke. That was just a random statement. But okay. Oh, either way, as we stated, we're going to be talking about this film in quite pretty much every detail, as well as getting into spoilers. So you have been warned. Spoiler alert. So as we dive in, this is going to be a pretty heavy conversation we're going to be diving into. So they're going to be kind of like, I guess, moments of conversation about politics, conversations about race, conversations about ultimately, you know, discrimination and the way of the world, as we would say it. So if you're triggered by that, we're giving you that warning as well. We are going to dive deep into this, and I don't want you to be taken aback if we do get into those kinds of weeds. So diving in, let's talk about expectations. Now, I don't know how much of an expectation you could have for a movie like this, especially with the trailer that we had, and knowing it's from Ryan Coogler, but I would like to know what was the best summation, if you will, of your expectations. And let's start with Amy.
Okay, so expectations for me, I really kind of didn't have any on purpose. So seeing the posters, all it said was Michael B. Jordan and Ryan Coogler, and I was like, I am willing and able to give this a shot and come in essentially almost completely blind. And I did it with intentionality. I did try to avoid trailers because stories and experiences that I've had with both of these creatives has been absolutely fantastic. So going in, all I knew was Michael B. Jordan was playing a twin. There was something going on. I didn't know what it was. And everybody had kept telling me it's horror. And I really did try to avoid any other spoilers outside of that. Besides people like, this is amazing, you should go see it. So I actually went in fairly like, I wanted to say pure, but I don't even think pure is the right word. Untainted. Yeah, I like that one. What about you, Spence?
There you go.
Yeah, let's see. I watched the first trailer for this movie, and I would like to say this is a really great example of a pretty well done trailer. Like, something that's enticing but doesn't give the story away, because like, if you would like give me like a synopsis of like, oh, this is about this, I'd be like, oh, I wouldn't have gotten that from the first trailer. So like, they really did a good job with that. But yeah, when they said, oh, it's got Ryan Coogler and Michael B. Jordan attached to it, so I was like, yeah, that's fine, I'll just go see it. I don't even need any more information than that.
Mm-hmm. Ready,
there you go.
Yeah.
Well, I guess I'm the only guy who really came in with any expectations here. But I mean, when you include the notions that Ryan Coogler is making a vampire movie, and we heard about this last year, and I believe it was,
I actually did not know that.
Yeah, it was mentioned at CinemaCon last year, I believe. It was announced at some point that it was, because obviously I have my ear to the ground when it comes to horror movies specifically.
Yeah.
And you hear the incredible Ryan Coogler is doing a vampire movie, and you know that he's working with Michael B. Jordan. You don't know really how you're going to posit that as far as like within your brain, like where does that fit? Does that fit within the mindset of like, okay, is this going to be a social commentary piece? Is this going to be an actual horror piece? Is he kind of stepping into the lane of what like Jordan Peele does? Is he going to do something unique and ultimately altogether different? I think The biggest thing for me is that Ryan Coogler has done so much to create such a name for himself that I think I don't want to say that he's put himself in the same position as M. Night Shyamalan, where he's created so much notoriety with him that I expect great things. You know, I expect to be moved. I expect, because he hasn't missed yet, you know, in spite of however the overall movie may turn out, his movies always still hit. I mean, for God's sakes, that trailer for Wakanda Forever alone, that opening sequence, you know, that rendition of, you know, No Woman, No Cry. I mean, like how do you stop yourself from like tearing up? Like everything about his pieces always have this sense of heart. Like the first two Creed movies, I believe, are directed by him. The third one was done by Michael B. Jordan, but the first two, and there's so much heart in those. It's like for me, who's a Rocky fan and a lover of the heart of what those movies are all about, Ryan Coogler hit it right on the head. I have yet to see a swing and a miss from Ryan. And so it's like, it's kind of the gift and a curse for me as a fan to come in and say, okay, cool, this is going to be a banger. And like, make sure, you know, that like, okay, it needs to be. Because in my mind, Ryan Coogler is one of those types of directors where you are hoping and praying that one day he doesn't, like that he never missed, that he always hits, he never misses, because his work just speaks for itself. Mm. So I think, unfortunately, and yet fortunately for me, like my expectations were, I expected great, and just pretty much that it lands, whatever it may be. Again, whatever lane it went into, whatever, however it presents itself, I was just hoping that it lands. So we all got a chance to see the film, however.
Together.
And we got to see it together.
Spencer was elated to sit next to me to watch me jump and laugh at certain points.
It was pretty great. It was pretty great to see Amy jump. So let's talk about first impressions. Right outside the gate. Sorry. Whew, the drink that I am drinking here has bubbles.
It got
bubbles. Let's start with Amy. Okay, let's start with...
No, because I have a feeling...
That was like a 1980s cartoon horror, like, villain voice.
No, I'm excited. First impressions literally was even sitting... First off, we need to establish, we sat all the way through all of the credits, like, mm-hmm. because that was the impact this film had, I think, on all of us. We were going to sit there regardless if there was anything at the end
or anything.
We were there. This was fantastic. I think we all agreed. I literally said, I turned to Spencer and I said, I need to see this again. And I turned to Eddie and I was like, I think they have it
in IMAX.
She turned
to Eddie and said, I told Spencer we need to see it again.
And even us getting out of the seats, Spencer, we were looking to watch it in IMAX before we recorded today. I have so many thoughts and so many wonderful things to say about this movie. Oh my gosh, the impression that it left on me is...
It sounds like we'll get into it.
Yes,
Spencer.
Okay, so you have to really go into like my English language knowledge to find a word that really...
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to go back on your diatribe about the bad English.
No, not here.
Because, I mean, we just heard about it on yesterday.
That was
just
you. It was because you're my friend and you have to hear me complain about it.
Well, it's just always on my mind. So,
This was like, I think the only word I can really use is mesmerizing. Just time, I was just like, what is happening? But in like the best way of like, this movie is constantly just like one-upping itself and surprising me through the entire watch process. To when you get to the credits, you are just left jaw dropped.
Yeah.
And I was like, this movie has so much going for it. What about you, Eddie?
Okay. Here's the thing. When it comes to movies, out of the three of us here, I'm usually the one who is never short of words. I usually have something to say, or I'm able to speak, I'm able to talk on. This movie absolutely changed me, I guess, is probably the best way to put it. It took me about 30 minutes.
Longer.
Okay. It took me about 45 minutes to an hour.
That's about
to
right.
finally say
something.
Anything about this movie. And the first thing that came out of my mouth when I was asked about this movie was, this is going to change cinema in every sense of the word. This is not just a film. This is a movement piece. This doesn't just entertain. This educates, informs, and advocates. And it's like, I pride myself in having a very verbose and robust, you know, dictionary of words within my brain. Mm-hmm. And I find myself coming up short with the best way to posit this film, to speak on this film in a way that I feel best fits it. Mesmerizing is a great word, but I still feel like it underplays what this movie does. And that's hard for me because I'm like, I do this here and I speak for this whole thing. And it's like, I can't for the life of me drum up the absolute exact word that is best to describe this movie without using over cliche words like masterpiece or work of art or you know, perfection. Like those are all words that have so much implication on it that, you know, where it sits. And in fact, you know, and we'll talk about it, but this movie has its flaws, but its overarching implications in the historical perspective of mankind and cinema and Americana, you know, it transcends above just film. And there's very few films that actually kind of hold that platform within, you know, the history of cinema. So yeah, this one did a number on me, but it's crazy. And to be quite frank, a lot of it stems from, and we'll kind of jump into the casting for this movie. You know, you got obviously Ryan Coogler, we've already talked to at length, but Ryan Coogler has absolutely floored with just about every film that he's come out with, all the way starting with Fruitvale Station, you know, back in what was that, 2012?
I thought it was, wasn't it 2009? I was just looking at that.
I might have my numbers all mixed up, but Fruitvale Station, 2013, I'm sorry. 2013, Fruitvale Station, all the way up to, as we stated, you know, with like Black Panther, Wakanda Forever, and then this with his Creed movies. I mean, pretty much every single movie that he has been a director on, that he has led and just built, has been something that's really made a name for itself. And so, yeah, I think Ryan, as someone who is also an alumni of Sacramento State here, you know, he carries a lot of that, you know, pride in what he does, and he does a lot to make sure that people don't misrepresent that his movies are just the product of him making money. His films are the product of his passions and his desires for change and movements in the world. So, but as far as performers in this film, actual performers in front of the camera, I mean, Michael B. Jordan, I think, is still an incredible actor. In spite of, you know, a lot of people who are saying like, oh, he's aging, he's doing this, he should be moving it. Like, Michael B. Jordan still looks like the same person that he was when he did that first Black Panther movie. He still looks like, I mean, oh my God, he still looks like when he was in Hardball. I don't know if you guys saw Hardball with Keanu Reeves. He was one of the little kids in that one. Like, it's like he never ages. He never changes. He is still...
He gets a little taller.
He does. I believe he was in... Wasn't he in... What was that? The Wire? He was in The Wire. Sadly, he gets shot in The Wire, I believe. But I mean, Michael B. Jordan is a phenomenal actor. And for him to actually play two roles in this particular one was... pretty pretty impressive. Playing two different brothers that are twins, obviously, but different, I guess, priorities, different.
They were each their own person. That's, I think, what you're trying to differentiate. So when we talk about Michael B. Jordan's performances, we're simultaneously speaking of not only his power as an actor in and of himself, but the ability to share space with himself on screen, and it's believable. And it's not just like, oh, you know, whomever is standing next to you. Each character is fully defined and has, even though they share a face and a last name, they are not the same person. Mm. And to have that in juxtaposition is just another hallmark of what a great actor he is.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
Boom.
Did you want to add anything to that, Spencer?
No, I think like he really nailed like the twins on the head so fantastically well, even though this film does a good job of like giving the twins a color palette. So like even without speaking, you kind of know who you're following. You almost don't need that because like he himself does such a good job of like portraying them as two separate individuals that like you're able to just track right along with them. And I'm like, that's really phenomenal.
Yeah. Yeah. Other performers in this film, obviously, we have Hailee Steinfeld, who is known obviously in circles for her musical ability and previous films that we know of, like with the Bumblebee film and so forth. But she's
Kate Bishop for the MCU.
And Kate Bishop for her series Hawkeye.
She's in the MCU too, just the TV MCU.
But this is one of those roles that I feel like still she was pushed out of her normal, I guess, comfort zone for what she's done in film, especially with her work in True Grit, which was her film debut with Jeff Bridges and so forth. I felt like she was a pretty vital part of this particular film, as like her storyline really created dynamic, I guess, issues within the brothership and those two, and ultimately when it happens, where, because you see it in the trailer where she does turn into a vampire, she does create a little bit of tension now in that part with somebody who they care about. She does a really good job though of building all those particular elements, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. I think she really did bring a lot to the table, and like I kind of didn't notice that it was her from like Hawkeye.
Yeah
Like I don't know what it is, but like there's something where she is able to like create such a distinction for herself that I wasn't even able to connect her to something she previously did. So like, but man, like I feel like I'm gonna repeat myself a lot when we're talking about the actors, but like she was also like really hitting it out of the park, because like, and I kind of feel like this is true for most of the actors.
Yeah,
everyone's just like hitting it out of the park with what they're doing, but like she like has such a unique role of like being like this living person with her own story, and then just gets turned into a vampire. Now, like, just dealing with the horror of that, like, you know, she just kills it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think especially because there are women within this cast. Again, we're going to talk, as Spencer stated, everybody in this cast comes out swinging, like even from smaller parts. Everybody is on their game. Like there is no weak link in this film for actors, period. And with Hailee, we have that space when we'll talk a little bit about the story where she is mulatto. She's mixed, but she's like, oh, my daddy's mom was black? And so that's the reason she's there. And then that's an entire other ball of wax. And we're still talking about performances, but having her in this inside of just the group of the actors, she doesn't miss. Like she feels comfortable. The space feels like she matches that energy and everybody's energy there. And yeah, when she gets turned into a vampire, like, well, that happened. And now she's outside and wants to eat people. Okay.
What do you call her? Mulatto?
Mulatto, yeah.
Oh, mulatto?
M-U-L-A-T-T-O.
What is that?
It's another way to say mixed race. Person, I picked it up from Once on This Island musical theater. Go me.
Oh, okay. That was okay. I didn't know. I mean, we just call people mixed. Well, I mean, I didn't know there was an actual like term for it. So
yeah, learn something new every day.
And speaking of other particular performers, I think obviously a lot of this film wouldn't have been possible without what is his name? I know his name, but like, where is he on the Sammy's character?
Miles
Caton.
Caton? Yeah. I think they have almost as an introduction in the cast when they did it.
Mm-hmm.
Miles. Holy crud.
Yeah. It's pretty impressive, his role, especially when you learn that he actually did most of the singing for this film, especially for a very impressive musical sequence that's midway through the film. His role is just, You are introduced with him, and then you end the film with him. And every part of this journey, I think, is just ultimately through the lens of his eyes. And it's pretty profound. And he does all justice to this character, all justice to this role. However Ryan Coogler envisioned it, Miles took it and just ran at 100 miles an hour with it. And I feel like this particular character is going to go down as one of the most like notable performances in film history. Because again, if anything is to be remembered about this movie, that musical sequence, just holy crap.
Oh gosh.
There's so many
music. Yeah, we're going to talk about music separately because there's so much going on.
Oh my gosh. Are you dusting off the Spencer's Big Score and you're going to talk about the score for
We're just going to talk about it all together. Okay.
We're just going to talk about it together. Like, sure. What am I doing? My bad for hoping it. God dang it.
No, but like, he did a phenomenal job for this being like his first acting credit on IMDb. Like, this is wild, like how impressive he was in this movie. Mm-hmm. Because like watching him, I would assume like, oh, he's been in the game for a long time if he's able to just like match everyone up like this. But no, this is like his first like acting credit. I'm like, this is just amazing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, this is absolutely going to send him to the stratosphere as far as his career.
Well, and even prior to that, okay, he's 20, so start off with that. He was a backup singer for her and was touring, and he got picked up for this. And I'm like, oh my Lord, like, where, young man, where have you been? Like, he doesn't, again, another one, which you think for like, an introduction or even for like your debut feature, that you're going to have some hiccups. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't. And again, another one that's played with earnesty, sincerity, and just a heart for this, like this film. And you're just like, I did not know until literally it said introducing and had his name that this was his first one. Cause it didn't feel like it.
Yeah, it didn't. Like, it felt like he was as experienced as most actors are when they come into a film like this. Like, this movie felt like it required nuanced performers who knew how to handle the landscape of not only the period they were in, but also in the social atmosphere they were in as well. And I would have never guessed, quite frankly.
Nope.
But speaking of being a heart of this film, another person I want to highlight is Annie, the character Annie, played by Wunmi Mosaku.
Yes, please. I love you.
Wunmi, who you may know more notably from either the Loki series or the Deadpool and Wolverine film.
Right at the end.
Right at the tail end of the film. She's one of the Time Variant agents.
She goes by Hunter B-15. You're welcome. But now she's in charge of the Time Variants. Yeah. Yes.
And she might be having a thing with, what's his name? Peter? No, is his name Peter?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Deadpool's friend Peter. Hey.
Oh my God. She absolutely killed it in this movie. As a love interest, as a standalone woman in this film, as just a woman who believes in the otherworldly. Everything about her rang with truth and just, it was oozing with tradition in who she was and what she brought to this part of the world as her character. The fact that what really irks me, and we'll get into more like my issues with other people, not with the movie, but my issue with other people was a lot of people looked at this movie, and one of the biggest complaints, and I thought it was, I think it is because it's still going on, but there is idiocy going on out there with certain people who go see the film who don't seem to comprehend that, and they're surprised when they come to find out that Annie was the love interest to, I believe it was Stack.
No, Smoke.
Was it Smoke? But she was the love interest to Smoke. And it's like, how do you misinterpret that? Like, it's quite obvious that they are in love. There's a relationship there. And it's like the ignorance of some people, because maybe she doesn't look like every other, you know, female love interest, or she's not fairer skinned than most black women or whatever. Like, there's this misinterpretation that you have to look a certain way so that way you can be a love interest that is
to Michael B. Jordan.
To Michael B. Jordan.
Well, that's stupid.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I did not hear any of that.
I'm so glad you did.
So here's the funny thing.
He got salty, but I was even saltier.
It's beyond, I mean, oh, you have no idea, Spencer, how pure. This is how pissed off I've been for the last few days since we've seen the movie. And not with the movie, but with the idiotic nature of people who feel they have a right to speak on the things of this movie. There are people out there who have spoken so specifically about this. Well, move the production table. There are people out there who have spoken about this, how they're like, oh my God, I didn't know that Annie was the one who was in love with Smoke. I thought she was like a mother figure or a friend or whatever. And it's like, where did you get that from? And it's like, why? And it kind of hits me. I was like, The only reason why you would think that is, number one, she's a darker African-American female. And number two, she doesn't look like what you would typically see, what you're used to, what your, I guess, desensitized brain is used to seeing when it comes to, you know, you think of a black female love interest, you're looking at something that probably is extra curves, extra whatever, or looks however. And
looks,
it's like,
more like Perla, which is another character that we do see that shows up at the juke joint.
Perlene?
Is it Perlene? I thought it was Perla. My bad.
No, it's Perlene.
I know her first name is Jamie. I just didn't remember her last name. So I was like, wait, that's the different person.
But it's like the ignorance of some people where it's like, it's a story. Follow the story. The story itself leads you to understand. Number one, there is a baby's grave right outside of this house. If this person is going to visit this grave and say, Papa's here, and then see this woman, and there's immediate like tension, like there's intimate tension there. Where do you not get that vibe that it's a relationship, that
it's such a weird comment.
It is.
Because like, the movie did, like, you know, a really good job, because, like, you know, for like, before he even says anything and you see that thing, I'm like, oh, is this like his
like, home?
It takes all of 5 minutes to really piece this together. And it's not like it's like, oh, the movie's being like, you know, vague. No, it was really kind of straightforward.
Right.
To the point where I don't understand where someone would come from of like, oh, that's not clear.
See, and the other thing too is I wonder if people have set an expectation because Michael B. Jordan is Michael B. Jordan in this, Michael B. Jordan has a standard, air quotes, to this societal beauty standards that's like, you need to be with a beautiful person. And the thing is, Woon Mi is gorgeous.
Yeah, she is.
Mm-hmm. She is stunning. She is statuesque. She carries her character, Annie, literally, and I can say this without shame, is as much of a linchpin to this film as the twins. Like, there is no one without the other. And there's a reason that Smoke is not only attracted to her, but the chemistry there is not subtle at all. It is not the Hailee Steinfeld and Stack energy, which is like, they're a little raunchy. They're kind of rowdy. Like, they get each other on a, we've grown up together and we're still butting heads, but we want to be together, but we can't because of not only the time, but because of the color of our skin. Like, you get all of that from both of them. But when it comes to Annie and Smoke, it is like the it is like the current underneath a still river. It is moving. Yeah. It will draw you in. Yeah. And all it is it's carrying so much weight. And it, again, it doesn't take you very long to see. Not only is he understanding of what he has, like when we get to the story aspect, that goes, but Wunmi is so just gorgeous and powerful. And I'm like, can I be your friend? Like, I want to sit under, and not, it's not just her as an actress, but also the power and
the presence
and the prominence that she places in Annie gives everything else more meaning. Mm-hmm. And when we start getting this,
it's been a very interesting. So it's been a very interesting ride coming out of the theater, and even actually when the film dropped, on the social side of things, like really seeing how people are reacting to not only, and again, we'll talk about this more, mm-hmm. but like the nature of not only what this film represents, but how it's being portrayed in the media, but whether by review or by word of mouth, and how people are responding to that reaction to the movie. And some of it is like, oh my gosh, it deserves all the praise. You need to, you know, go see this, blah, blah, blah. To certain people saying, well, why are we protecting Ryan Coogler? You know, he should be, you know, fair game for negative review. We should be able to criticize him without
having political backlash.
And this is one of those things that came up. It's like, oh, like the fact that people are uncertain about things like this really kind of, you know, epitomize it recognizes and puts on high alert the ignorance some people have when it comes to movies and when it comes to, you know, dynamics within couples. Like, it's just, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, Wunmi does an absolute phenomenal job in the role. She is such fantastic. A staple. On the other side of that, not other side, but like on another incredible performer in this movie that I thought absolutely did phenomenally well was the role of Delta Slim, played by Delroy Lindo. Delroy, if you guys aren't familiar, Delroy Lindo has been a actor in film and TV and everything else for years.
Literal years.
But he is also a prominent activist and advocate for equality and Black activism.
He has a Tony. Come on.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. And his role in this particular film as Delta Slim was pitch perfect. I mean, it fit every single bell. It rang every single note. It absolutely was spot on for that particular character that Ryan Coogler set out to create. I mean, he's talked about it at length in interviews, talking about how like he wanted to come in and he was talking about doing this, and then he took a direction from Ryan to do this, and it just made the character. And it's like his role and the performances therein, like everything that he did, including that conversation that he has when he's talking about his friends who got money and the guy who ended up going to the train station with all that money and what ended up happening. And it's like, that whole story and the way he told it and the way it just feels like the way you would have to explain something while recognizing that that's just the way the world is, you know, it rings with so much truth in not only the delivery, but the reaction of it after the fact. Like, and I don't think anybody else could have landed those lines and landed that role as well as him. Mm-mm. I mean, he was absolutely phenomenal. Was there anybody you wanted to highlight, Spencer?
Oh, geez. See, here's the thing. I liked everybody. okay, let's go with, because I believe this was the main bad guy, Jack O'Connell's Remick.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Man, he had some screen presence.
Yeah.
Like, you know, comes off as like smooth talking when he wants to and threatening when he wants to. Like, he is able to just pivot like on like this pin of like what he needs to do at like that moment is what he comes across as. And it's really fascinating to just watch him, like, you know, just be from charming to very threatening to very scared to very threatening again. Yeah. Like, it's like really impressive, like how much like he works as like just a threat to keep the entire movie going. Mm-hmm. Like, I was actually just really impressed by him.
Yeah. And I'm going to piggyback a little bit on this because, again, he is, you are in the first, for the first portion of this movie, you're like, okay, we think one particular villain is the villain. And you're, but then you're also simultaneously waiting for your like vampires. Where are the vampires? Because this is what people are like, it's a vampire movie. And you're waiting. And when Jax Remick shows up and the way he shows up initially, you're like, no. And then when he finally gets to the juke joint and he has the interaction with the rest of the full cast and you're like, oh, you're not just the seduction, like the Gary Oldman seduction Dracula type of energy. You're like the, I am going to encourage, and it's the here, kitty, kitty, like come to me type of energy. Mm-hmm. And then the flop is so just like, it's menacing and violent. And again, it's in this such a weird space. And again, part of the story, we have to talk about the story because it directly impacts his character. But Jack did such a great job I'm like, I don't know if I could see anybody else doing it too. And I think that's another thing to talk about too when it comes to like this cast. I don't see, and I wanted to talk about two other people really fast, and I'll do this little thing and then I'll jump on them. I don't see a space where if we recast this cast, it would have the same presence and gravitas as it does right now.
No, you'd get something different.
Right?
You'd have a whole different, ultimately, outlook on the film. You'd have a whole different message. I feel like it would ultimately change the trajectory of the whole movie altogether. Like, plain and simple. Not to say that there isn't anyone else who is capable, but the magic that happens on screen for this particular cast and this particular film and the way it's shot and the way it was edited, the way it was cut, for every single subtle nuance to every single loud and bombastic moment, it was magic. And it would be darn near impossible to recapture every single piece of that to make it this.
Yeah. And so the last two people I really want to touch on just really quickly is Lin Jun Lee and Yao. Lin Jun Lee plays Grace Chow. And then Yao, that's his name, plays Bo Chow. They are two of the three people that we see that are in this town that are of Chinese descent, Chinese immigrant. There are a couple other people in the background, including their daughter, Lisa. But when it comes to them,
well, you said one of three, but yeah,
because those are the ones that actually have names in the credits. They are, again, Grace, totally unexpected in the way that we, when we first meet them, Smoke has come to get supplies from Bo, and Bo runs two stores on opposite sides of the street. One is for, segregation is still around. So one is for immigrant people, because it's not just black people. It is everybody else. And the other side is white. And his wife runs the white store. And Bo runs the black store. But Smoke meets him. He comes in and there's this immediate camaraderie. It's like, we're friends. We've been friends for a long time. What do you need? How can I help you? What can we do? And then the transition, which we can talk about shots too. Oh my gosh, the shots.
Are you talking about shots or are you talking about actors? Because you're getting into things.
I'm talking about the interaction between Michael B. Jordan's Smoke and Grace and Bo. It's just, again, another one that feels really natural. And the chemistry feels so organic and it's effortless and has such a good push and pull to it that when we get farther into the film, you actually see what turns up of it. And it's really cool.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm getting really excited.
Yeah, it's like, oh my God, she's doing it again. She's doing the intern Amy things again. So jumping into
okay,
let's go ahead and talk into the story. What's that? You want me to turn you down or you want me to make your voice?
Are you going
to
do that again?
No.
I can hear you. What's that? See, if I scare her into doing it, she won't talk.
Dead
see,
oh, dang. See,
I'm not making dead air. You are. So talking about the story, let's go ahead and talk about the actual story of the film in terms of, not the, because we've already mentioned the synopsis of the film, but let's talk about the story itself. This movie takes place during the
1932.
Is it 1932?
Yeah,
correct.
So it's after World War One.
Right.
And obviously we have these two twin brothers who are coming back from the war after doing things. It's sometime after the war. Because they're mentioned as ultimately war veterans. Mm-hmm. They were in World War One and they were in Chicago and now they're here to do X, Y, and Z. They're going to ultimately open a juke joint, which is essentially a nightclub for folks to listen to blues music, predominantly black people. That's what they were called back then. And we get this whole story that unfolds as they buy this place, they get the stuff ready. It's ultimately, the whole film takes over the course of an overnight time frame. That's the whole film. Like it's from like midday one day up until the morning of the next. And that's the whole movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it's crazy to think like all of this in the movie that we see is just over those hours of time frame, less than 24. But the story of that we get unfolding is not even one about the vampires. It's about the implication of how deeply connected we are within like our tradition and our history and the forces that are out there to kind of upset those things. I mean, the kind of crux of this movie is the brothers ultimately bring in their little cousin to come in and play the blues guitar that they bought him, which ultimately is an iconic guitar from back in the day. I believe it actually is Buddy Guy's original. Well, I don't know if it's his original, but it's a copy, I believe.
There's one little goof, though, that the guitar that he actually uses came out in 1932. When it was set, but they're like, oh, they've had it for so long. And I was like, it's okay. No, it's for the guitar people. I'm totally okay with that.
I mean, mind you, it doesn't actually say when they got it for him because it could have been some time in 1932. I'm just, there's whatever. Either way.
Said 7 years prior, but that's okay.
Did they?
Yep. Stack said it.
Whatever.
Yay. again, I'm still okay with being like, that's a great guitar. It is gorgeous. Mm-hmm. I don't know when you got it, but you know what? You got it now. So we're here.
So ultimately they bring him on board. They bring in Delroy Lindo's character, Delta Slim. They bring in a bunch of people. They pretty much set up the whole place and they open it up and Sammy ends up playing a song of his that ultimately encapsulates how deeply connected again we are to how music ultimately connects us all to the deep rootedness of our heritage and our tradition. And it's, if we could just stop for a second there again, this musical sequence is phenomenal. This musical sequence is without a doubt, probably one of the best musical sequences I have ever seen in terms of cinematography, in terms of color palette, in terms of practical effect, in terms of camera work.
It's a long shot.
It's all a long shot.
Just plain creative.
It is absolutely creative.
I never would have thought of blending all those different styles of music together to just like show you the effect of music across time. Mm. Like that was just so wildly unexpected.
And it's everywhere too, because even in that sequence, we have the Chows, and that sequence still incorporates them too with music. Like we get a voiceover at the beginning that says that there are some people that are born to pierce the veil with music and can bring forth the past and the future. And you see it, like you get to have an experience that is, my jaw was literally on the floor. Like I can't. See, even now I'm having problems formulating words because there is so much that is happening in just this, and there's multiple musical sequences, but this musical sequence, the one we're talking about, the long shot, this one literally you believe that it pierced the veil, that it ripped open something and has transcended all things in film and music simultaneously in this one long take.
Well, and then obviously you get the whole styling of this scene and the way it's painted and the way it's, you know, just choreographed, like the choreography of this entire scene literally embodies the painting. Everyone's already talked about it by now at this point, but Ernie Barnes, the artist, he created a painting back in 1976 called the Sugar Shack. Sorry.
Sugar Shack, yeah.
And everything about this scene that you see as everybody is writhing in rhythm and in dance and in passion.
And
celebration and joy. And it emulates to a T this painting. And it's like when you look at the two, it's hard to absolutely just, you know, tell the difference. Have you seen it, Spence?
I'm not sure what we're talking about.
Okay, so there's a painting. So the sequence we're talking about, there's a painting called The Sugar Shack. And if you look it up, they also, the marketing team created a...
Oh, yeah, I've seen that painting before. Yeah.
So
this is the painting that obviously they took full inspiration for, you 100%. Know, that juke joint scene. But it's so incredible how Ryan Coogler incorporated so much to recognize within this scene without stating, oh, that's a promotional.
And the poster, and they also created a poster as well. But the energy of the Sugar Shack is in wholly this the sequence. And you're just like, my gosh.
Yeah, it looks exactly like that.
Yeah, but it's insane, like how much. And then, mind you, we just talked about like the technical side of how great this scene is. The actual what happens in that scene is a whole other story. Excuse me. Because this scene, as Amy mentions, like there's this mention about how music, you know, is, you know, capable of piercing the veil between, you know, our world and the other world and you know, whatnot. And this scene ultimately is a depiction of Sammy doing just that. And Sammy ultimately creates this connection where you start seeing entities and spirits of people who have also held that position, held that ability, that gift, showing up in different avenues of the African heritage. You know, like you have, it's insane. Like, yeah, like it really goes.
It is something I simultaneously want to talk about, but I don't want to spoil for people because you want people to have that experience. Like it is one of those things that it is a, like, and Eddie said, we're going to probably wear the word masterpiece out. I will find the thesaurus and find other words.
Yeah, I'm already having to look up a synonym thing here.
But that sequence alone in and of itself stands out as a shining beacon of not only what Ryan Coogler can do, but how a story is the whole of its parts. And in that instance, you truly feel like you want to dance, you want to move, but you are awestruck in what is happening. And it's like in juxtaposition to other musical moments that happen, including the one that comes almost fairly quickly afterwards. The comparison between the two is totally, they are not simultaneous. They're similar, but they're not. And I say that because each of them serves a different purpose and an understanding. But when Sammy literally pierces the veil, and at the end of the shot, it's like the entire building has been burned. And we can talk about that because of the way that the shot looks. The building around them is burned down, but they are fully in the celebration and the joy of it. And all you're thinking of is, I want to be there.
Yeah. it's done that well. And it's done that, you know, movingly, like where it is an absolute, for lack of a better term, it's a barn burner, like quite literally. and the scene, like, just again, I'm a big music lover. I've been playing music. Spencer, you have also been playing music a while. Amy, she's a singer. She loves music as well. So she's
no, you can't hear me quoting lyrics on our episodes ever.
She likes to sing, but either way, she has a passion for music as well. Like the fact that our heart for music is absolutely filled when we see, when we watch this scene, when we engage with this scene, when we ingest this scene, like we cannot say enough how much this fills your heart if you're a fan of music and especially a fan of the cinematography of these types of things. And then ultimately we get our introduction. Well, we don't get our introduction there, but we are then around the same time, we're also introduced to our main antagonist, Remick, who is of Irish descent. Mm-hmm. And again, there is a lot of similarity when you draw the lines between Death from Puss in Boots, The Last mm-hmm. Wish, and Remick, because there is a sense of like foreboding and just a level of confidence that is otherworldly, but not cocky. It is like an assured confidence that Remick carries that I think carries over pretty well from, you know, the Puss in Boots film.
Well, and the difference between the two is in The Last Wish, which we recommend if you've never seen it, please go mm-hmm. watch Puss and Boots, The Last Wish.
Yeah. Push and Boosh.
It's fantastic. And in watching this, we know what is chasing Boots is death. Mm-hmm. And in this, there is some of the foreboding, but nobody on the outside sees it. Nobody in that world sees it. And so we're literally front and center to the danger, to the knowing. Where I don't believe it's fully a spoiler, but prior to us meeting Remick, mm-hmm. there is a very, very brief moment yeah. where there are Native Americans.
Choctaw Native yeah, Americans.
That have been hunting Remick. And
because they know, and obviously if you go historically, yep. sorry, not to cut go you off, it. But like historically, if you go through the history of Native Americans in this country, there's always been a sense of like one foot in you know, the real world and one foot in the supernatural. There's always an awareness. There's always a being mindful of. And the fact that in this film, our introduction is the fact that Remick, who is this otherworldly entity that his only means is to do evil in this world and introduce evil into it, is being pursued by these Choctaw Indians. The fact is like that should have set you off right away to let you know kind of how bad this person is, that for some people like the Native Americans who are not really wanting to have to deal with the discrimination and whatnot in a world where people look down on anyone whose shade of color on their skin is less than, you know, vanilla. So it's like it's not really something they'll do, but they came out to pursue this thing.
Yeah.
With and even the concern that they're knocking on the door at sundown.
Yeah, before sundown.
Right at sundown that they're knocking on the door of this home that is owned by this white family.
Who's a Klan's person.
Who obviously there's a Klan outfit in the backdrop and they're still telling them like, hey, this person is dangerous. And as soon as they're like, nope, you need to go.
They're like, cool. We're going
it's all
home.
Yours. Bye.
Bye. Like the warning of it is like, hey, there's something bad. If you have to see it, just be safe. Don't let them in. And the homesteaders that are there are like, yeah, you need to get out of here. And they're like, cool. Hands off. We're done.
Yeah.
Like the warning of them in and of itself too, but also the understanding that there would be danger for them if they had mm-hmm. tried to press the issue. I was like, that makes sense. Yeah. That's historically yeah. like, they're like, hey, there's a problem. You're not listening to us. Okay. We're going to go then.
They're like, cool, bye.
You're on your own.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then when we do meet Remick.
The second time around
where he approaches the juke joint after being called by that scene, yeah. which all of us are like, oh my gosh, anybody would have been called by that scene.
Not in the way that Remick was called.
No. So, and then with the people that he brings as well,
which was the family that he had entered the home of because he was invited in,
yep.
Which they don't outright establish it as a vampire kind of mode of operandum. But everybody who's been watching vampire movies for as long as vampire movies have been around, it's kind of rule number one. You don't ever invite a vampire in. Yep. So I love also the fact that people are like paying attention and recognizing after the fact on social media. They're like, oh, I just realized that you're not supposed to invite vampires in. I get it now.
Well, it's the same thing. Like even if we did, what was it? The Nicolas Cage, Nick Holt.
Renfield?
Yes. So remember the Matt said, come on in. And he took that as that he could walk into his house because it gave him permission. I was like, thank the Lord that those were not around for these guys. Because all somebody needs is one doormat that says, come on in. Everybody's coming in. That's a no-no.
But as you mentioned, those three, the husband and the wife, as well as Remick, do approach at the tail end of that musical sequence with Sammy and the barn burning, or the juke joint burning down.
Metaphorically. It's still up.
Yeah. And they're approaching because they hear, Remick is hearing the music, he's feeling it, and they try to gain entrance into it, and that's kind of where things kick off for this story. Honestly, like, I just, let's talk like just implications of this story. Like, I feel like, first off, it doesn't do really anything different with vampires, but the way of their pursuit of their desires is different. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like the, cause I don't want to say priorities, cause I don't want to sound like it's a corporate thing. Like, oh, we're looking to take over. But like, I feel like,
I mean, kind of did feel a little corporate when he's like, I am the head man.
He doesn't say I am the head man.
No,
thankfully.
He doesn't.
So thank God. Like, Ryan Coogler, what were you thinking? But no, like there's a sense of like the desire of Remick, the desire of what he wants with, ultimately killing everybody and then them coming back as vampires is part of an overall goal that he feels is going to do good to the world. Like
love and community.
It's crazy. Cause it's like you're looking at it and you're like, this doesn't track for any vampire story you've ever heard. You're like, okay, the design, typical. The way they, I guess, transfer their vampirism, it's okay, typical. The invitation in, that's typical.
The wards, typical.
The words, typical.
Wards.
Wards. Oh, yeah, the wards. The
garlic crosses, giant stick.
I don't think they use a cross in this one.
No, they don't.
But yeah, stake through the hearts and stuff like that. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Thank you, Annie. Again. She's just coming in clutch all the time.
But their overall desire is very unique and it's very interesting. And I feel like that's on purpose. Mm. You know, I feel like the drive to assimilation for a better world.
It's Borg energy, baby. It is Borg energy all day. And it's not just a better world. Like if we're talking about the significance of the two separate moments too, Remick's desire to have everyone under one banner, under one unity, and under love and fellowship is how they say it. It is a drive simultaneously in this way that he's almost a sympathetic vampire when we get farther down the line. Initially, evil, evil. We're like evil, evil, evil. But Remick also comes to a point where we understand the Irish were there at the export for the Irish was humans. They were colonized long before because they were, you know, just north of England, of, you know, Great Britain. They were colonized and oppressed as well. And everything that they identified was stripped away from them and was deemed as evil. There's the Irish that were living around in that time. It was no Irish need apply because they were the other, quote unquote, white devil. And the thing is that when all of your identity, all of your history has been, again, shunned, stripped away, the only thing that you can think is, if I can't beat them, I might as well join them, which is kind of that drive that I felt with Remick was being presented in this, where he's like, listen, I'm not only is he a vampire as an outcast, but he's Irish. And he's like, he's passing, right? Because he's white. So he is one step above the black caste, the black community that's in there. So he's like, I can still oppress them. But if they're with me, then we're all under one. Like yeah. it's a force to make everybody, conform. Ah, there it is. Like yeah, to make them conform. And it's weird. But
yeah, because I feel like there's like some implication behind like the whole terminology of like, you know, drinking the juice, like, you know, drinking the Kool-Aid. You know, if you join me and you give up the innermost part of what makes you, then you can join a collective where we don't see race. We don't see color. There's no difference between white, black. We're all, quote unquote, equal in this sense. But it does require the very most part that makes you you. And once you give me that, or once you give up that, then we can all have the same mentality of like, oh, you know what? We shouldn't worry about racism, because you know what? Racism is a ridiculous thing. Everybody's equal because, you know, you're white, I'm black. This is this, that, and that. And it's like, there's some kind of implication in like Ryan Coogler stating like, that is the way people, I guess, make it okay for certain things to happen in the world. Make it make sense, almost condoning, you know, the nature like of why some people say, oh, well, you know, let's take, for instance, the current, you know, political, you know, landscape where we are, like, oh, you know, Trump is fine because, you know, he did this, this, and that, and, you know, he's doing this for black families and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, dude, he's not recognizing, you know, actual races. He's absolutely, you know, not doing anything for the working people, the working class. Like there are actual things that he's doing that are actually hurting minority groups, but you're okay with it because he said he's going to do X, Y, and Z for you. It's like, there's this sense of like, we as a society are so on the edge of being willing to drink in the Kool-Aid, and we're so willing because we're afraid, for lack of a better term, we're afraid of the smoke. We're afraid of having to fight. We're afraid of having to put our foot down and let people know that we exist for a purpose and for a reason, and those are our own. They don't belong to anyone else. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like the biggest thing I was mentioning about the vampires, the reason why that switch is so prominent, and it's not like any other vampire movie we've seen, is like, because we're not fighting the, you know, Smoke and Stack and Annie and all Mary and all the rest of them, you know, who are in there. They're not fighting against vampires. They're fighting against the ability to exist uniquely and equally without having to join the collective. And it's like, it's so beautifully done because it's a monstrous thing. I mean, you look at the world today, and mind you, at this table, we're looking at three different, you know, ethnic and traditional groups, whether if it's, you know, Spencer is African American, I'm, you know, Latin descent, Hispanic descent, Amy's Jewish, as well as female, you know.
Oh, I was waiting for you to say and white, because that part is in there too.
I'm sorry. I'm trying to make I was literally trying. Spencer, I was trying.
No, you were.
Remick over here has to bring it all down.
I'm not Irish. Like, I am not Irish.
Okay. But the fact is, like, we represent three unique groups as well. Mm-hmm. And the fact is, we daily fight against that when it comes to not only making ourselves heard, but being recognized as the unique parts of who we are and not just a collective. Because we from the aspect of turning a blind eye to what is happening to our brothers and sisters of ethnic descent, to even recognizing the idiocy of some of the things that are done within our ethnic descent. Mm-hmm. You know, we're looking at like, it's like, we are not defined by the follies of our ethnicity. We are not defined by the people who choose to act out in negativity or violence without cause of those in our ethnicity, nor are we defined by the people who choose to, you know, carry a sense of authority and try to put us in that box or try to dismiss, you know, our right to exist. It's very on the nose. And the fact is like, a lot of what it is probably the reason why people have so much trouble with this movie, or they have so much trouble with the success of this movie. Because if people are actually having a good time with a vampire movie, and they're also getting educated, if you will, mm-hmm. even subliminally, mm-hmm. then of course there's going to be people who are like, oh, you know what? This is so bad. Why are we talking about this? Why are you guys even doing this? Why are you guys even, you know, mentioning?
Well, and we can also really kind of come into, when we're looking at in juxtaposition to the musical moments. The song that Sammy does is an expression of not only his uniqueness, but without even knowing, it is him. It is him now. It is what he's experiencing now. And
it's ultimately a declaration of, you know, his self-identity.
Yeah.
The song is ultimately a declaration of his self-identity.
Yeah. And then when we get to where Remick, when we first meet Remick and homesteaders.
Sorry, I don't mean that metaphorically. It's literally a song about his self-identity.
It's him, a song from his to his dad.
To his dad about who he is as a man.
Yeah. And then when we get to Remick, which first off, when Remick shows up the first time and it's only got the other two vampires, when he sings the song, Pick Poor Robin Clean, oh, everybody knows something sketchy with that song. Like, it's not only the history of that song, but the understanding of the people that originally sung it. And it has multiple origins as well. But the tone of it being a folk song, and they're just like merrily picking away.
Yeah, it's essentially, so Pick Poor Robin Clean, it's essentially an old black song where people would sing, black folks would sing it about gambling in the late 1800s.
That's one of them. The two women that sang it in the 1900s, it was about Cock Robin, which is a poor, gullible person. And as you had stated when you leaned over to me in the theater and you're like, that's about murdering somebody and taking all of their stuff. And I'm like, yeah, that tracks, still tracks. But then also when you apply it in this sense, you don't even have to understand the origin or all of the different meanings to be like, this is the Run Rabbit Run song in Nope. No, Get Out. Sorry.
I was like, wait.
I was like, no, wrong one. Right director. But that song and then this and everybody who's standing listening to the song because the vampires are outside and everyone's kind of listening. Everyone's just like, no, there's something wrong. There's something, and they can't put their finger on it. And I'm like, trust your intuition. Trust the community's intuition. We're holding on to this. And meanwhile, Haley Steinfeld's like, oh, they seem nice. We should like, and I'm like, girl. No, even I'm like, I'm sorry. These people walked up and they're singing and they're standing at your door and y'all don't feel comfortable and they want to come into your safe space, your celebration space. And they want to, without you even knowing, take over into a place that, let's be honest, they have no purpose of being there. And I say this with the understanding community events are community events, but this is specifically a juke joint. This is for everyone that is working on the plantations as sharecroppers. As I'm certain that there are some people there that are still slaves that are here in some way, shape, or form. Like, it's not, you're in the space between the civil rights movement and Jim Crow
desegregation.
Thank you. My brain is like spinning.
There's a lot to talk about with this movie because it's like there's so many things to like derive from it and to really kind of pull from it.
That's right. There is so much to talk about in this film. So much so that we had to make two parts. This was the end of part one of our conversation about Ryan Coogler's Sinners. So come back next week as we dive deeper into the situations that are surrounding this movie, as well as some of the controversial takes that people have when it came to not only the director, but also the film. In the meantime, why don't you head over to our website where we got allegedly over 300 episodes, everything from action, anime, comedy, suspense, thrills, and chills. If you're looking for it, we got it. Head on over to our website at filmlosopherspodcast.com. You can also check us out wherever the socials are, as far as facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter and Instagram and threads at filmlosophy101. You can also check us out at Blue Sky at filmlosopherspodcast.com. Over at our Instagram page, that's where we post all of our extra content, such as Spencer's Big Score and Amy's Jane on Scene, which can be found the only place it's ever lived, which is on Instagram and Instagram only at Jane on Scene. If you're looking for a place where you can listen to us on the podcast app, you can look for us over at iTunes, Libsyn, Player FM, Audioboom, Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn, iHeart, Amazon Music. Tune into your heart's desire on any one of those platforms. Look for us there at The Filmlosophers. Give us a follow or subscribe. Listen in and tell us what you think. If you like what you hear, give us a 5-star review. We've earned it. There's you're repeating me. Don't worry. Also, if you like the film, let us know your thoughts over in the comment section down below. We'd love to hear them. We read those. We definitely like to check to see what everyone else is thinking. Again, this is the first of two parts of our Sinners review. And of course, we can't wait to connect with you again next week. So From all of us here at the Filmlosspers, I'm Eddie, he's Spence, she's manager intern Amy. Class dismissed.